From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. It's been a little more than a week since the last U.S. Air Force C-17 took off from the airport in Kabul, ending this phase of America's decades-long involvement with Afghanistan. Later on the program, we'll talk with organizations working to resettle Afghan refugees here in Illinois. But first, I'd like to welcome one of our U.S. Senators, Dick Durbin, back to the program to talk about Afghanistan and more. Senator Durbin, thank you for being here.
Good to be with you.
And listeners, in order to meet the senator's schedule, we're taping this conversation Tuesday afternoon, so we're not taking calls during the program, but you can always let us know what you thought. Send an email to talk@21stshow.org. So, Senator, this is the first time we've spoken since the fall of Kabul and America's departure from Afghanistan. We've seen assessments ranging from President Biden should be impeached to there's no good way to lose a war. Where are you on ending the mission in Afghanistan and particularly how America left?
I, of course, share the view of a majority of the American people that we had stayed in Afghanistan too long, the longest war in American history. I was one of those senators. In fact, it was a unanimous vote in the Senate that approved the invasion of Afghanistan. Our goal was very direct. We were going to find Osama bin Laden, hold him responsible, and disband al-Qaeda, his organization. We achieved that goal 10 years ago, and still we stayed in Afghanistan. And that decision to stay indefinitely was one that unfortunately led to the decision that President Biden made, that I think he accurately made, that it was time to leave.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the vote. It was 3 days after 9/11 for the authorization for use of military force. As you mentioned, 98-0 in the Senate. I think Representative Barbara Lee of California, one Democrat in the House, voted against it. What do you think of that vote 20 years later?
Well, I can tell you that I voted about that same time against the invasion of Iraq. 23 senators voted no, 22 Democrats, myself included, and one Republican senator. That, I still believe, was one of the most important votes I've ever cast. The decision on Afghanistan was much different. We had just lost 3,000 innocent Americans on 9/11. And the basic question I was asking myself and everyone is asking of the Senate, if you don't make Osama bin Laden pay for doing this, what are we saying to the next terrorist? I believe that that was a valid point, and that's why I voted for the invasion.
Should the Senate have withdrawn that authorization for use of military force earlier, though? You said it sounds like you think the mission should have ended after the assassination of bin Laden, or I guess I don't know how you want to phrase that, but after bin Laden was found, should that have been the end of the mission? And why didn't Congress work to end it then?
Well, many of us are pushing Congress and the United States Senate in particular to do just that. It's called AUMF, Authorization of Use of Military Force. We voted for it to go after Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. After that goal was achieved 10 years ago, many of us believed it was time to reopen the debate. Why were we still there? You know, the final accounting, and it isn't final by any means, but to date, in Afghanistan is very clear. The United States paid a heavy price, 2,261 American lives were lost, 20,000 were seriously wounded, more than $2 trillion of American taxpayers' dollars were spent, and I will tell you, many of them were wasted and stolen. We were there for 20 years with the notion of building up an Afghan security force to stand up for their own country against the Taliban. When they were challenged at the end, they threw down their rifles and ran. It's a terrible commentary, but it suggests that the notion of nation building and imposing our values on a country like Afghanistan was unrealistic. It was time for it to end, and we should have debated it again.
What about the Americans who were left behind, including Illinois native Mark Frericks, who was working as a civil engineer, as I understand it, in Afghanistan, is apparently being held by the Taliban? Is there anything that can be done for him and the other American citizens who were not evacuated before the final U.S. forces left?
I haven't had a conversation with Secretary Blinken or even Secretary of Defense Austin where Mark Frericks' name has not been brought up. I am in touch with his family in Illinois. I understand how strongly they feel that we need to keep the attention focused on his capture and his safe return. And it's another argument for those who say, cut off the Taliban, have nothing to do with them, don't even talk to them. You know, Mark Frerich's life hangs in the balance here. We need to have an opening, at least some sort of conversation with the Taliban in the hopes that we can bring him home safely, as well as the other Americans.
Was it wrong to let the Taliban dictate our departure date because of cases like Frerich's, and not to mention our many Afghan partners who were also left behind? I know we evacuated a lot, but there were many who were not able to get to the airport even.
Well, this is what it came down to, and the decision was made by the previous president, Donald Trump, through Secretary of State Pompeo, to negotiate directly with the Taliban last year before Biden was even elected to the presidency. And the notion was we were leaving, and we wanted a promise from the Taliban that they would not kill Americans or American soldiers during the time of our departure. And President Trump picked a finite date, a specific date, when it was time to leave. And I'm sure the Taliban wanted to hold him to it. Joe Biden inherited that. He tried to move the date this way and that way, but it became more difficult. And that created the chaos toward the end, when so many Americans, for example, thousands who had been warned it was time to leave, finally decided this was the time and tried to hurry to the airport to get it done. That chaotic situation ended in tragedy when 13 Americans lost their lives.
I want to ask about the Afghan refugees now. I mentioned we're talking with some organizations later in the show. How do you think about the refugees coming to Illinois? Is there a set number Illinois should accept or seek to accept? Where they're located? What are you thinking about that?
I'm not picking a number, but I want to make it very clear. These men and women from Afghanistan, many of them risked their lives for America, a country they had never seen. For the American soldiers, people they'd never known before the experience of our invasion of Afghanistan, and they risked their lives for us. I believe we have a moral obligation to prove our values as a nation, to stand up and to be on their side and bringing them to this country to let them restart their lives. This has happened many times throughout our history, and there are wonderful stories of refugees who were thoroughly vetted, brought to the country, given a helping hand by the communities and churches and synagogues, temples, and made a life for themselves and made it a better country here. Let's prove what America's worth. Let's show our gratitude to these men and women.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. He is the number two Democrat in the Senate. He's also chairman of the Judiciary Committee. And I want to turn now to the new anti-abortion law in Texas. You've said that you plan to hold a hearing on that and on the Supreme Court's so-called shadow docket. I want to put a pin in that aspect of this for now. But with regard to the Texas law, this is a civil court matter, not a criminal state court matter. What role is there for the federal government here?
Well, I think there's a very valid role because this is a direct assault on a constitutional right. Imagine, if you will, what Texas has done here. They've said that any person can bring a civil lawsuit against any other person involved in abortion before, after 6 weeks of viability. And I should say, the definition is a little tough, but it's after 6 weeks of gestation. And that person who brings the lawsuit, no matter where they live or for whatever reason they have behind the lawsuit, can recover a minimum of $10,000 plus legal fees. This has really created a vigilante justice system in Texas. It is an outrage to think that they would approve such a thing. Some say, well, other states will do the same thing. I hope that's not the case. I think this needs to be challenged. We're going to have a hearing on it and bring up the very real problems that it creates.
You know, one of the reasons this is making the news is not just for the law itself, but because of how the Supreme Court, or at least a 5-4 majority on the Supreme Court, did not decide to block this novel law from going into effect while it was undergoing a legal challenge, which is something that happens pretty commonly. This happened on, as you know, the court's so-called shadow docket, right? This is where cases are brought up for sort of emergency orders. There aren't full oral arguments and a full briefing schedule. I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about that. Aren't there good reasons to have the justices be able to act quickly, like when staying in execution or something like that? There is a role for this, right?
Of course there is. But what we're finding is that the Supreme Court, this Supreme Court, is using this more and more for historic decisions sometimes very controversial decisions, without a hearing, without an explanation, just a simple vote. In this case, a 5-4 vote. John Roberts, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, sided with the three liberals on the court and said this was wrong, that there should have been a hearing and a decision. He knew what was at stake here. It was a constitutional right. And I have sat through the hearings on, I believe, five or six of the current Supreme Court justices and heard each one of them, when asked about Roe versus Wade, the decision that set up standards for abortion in America, to say this was settled law. This is established precedent. And to really tell us in the Judiciary Committee that as justices on the Chief Court in the land, that they were going to honor this law. And yet when it came time for the Texas statute to be evaluated, they wouldn't even do it publicly, not even with a public argument before it was all over. I think that was an outrageous use of their procedural authority, and that's why I believe a hearing is necessary.
So what would be the options? I mean, how much authority does Congress have in terms of dictating how the judicial branch operates, how the Supreme Court operates?
Well, it's a separate branch, and if we are not prepared to pass a law or to change the Constitution, it's very limited. Remember, I serve in a 50-50 Senate, 50 Democrats, 50 Republicans. An issue with any controversy attached to it is going to be difficult to get a majority. They know that. So Texas has decided to challenge it now, and they believe, even with a Democratic president, that they have a chance of holding up this constitutional right that has been on the books for 50 years.
In the few minutes we have remaining, I want to turn to COVID-19. We're seeing, as you know, a resurgence of cases in Illinois. Hospitals say they're running out of critical care beds, especially in southern and central Illinois. I wonder specifically about schools. There's been so much controversy over mask mandates. Of course, the governor has decided that school children should wear masks coming back. But as we move into a COVID vaccine, hopefully being approved for children younger than age 12, school-age children, should that be made mandatory as well as masks have here in Illinois?
I can tell you that I'm old enough to remember when the polio vaccine was discovered. It was a breakthrough. And finally, what a great relief. We had a vaccine against this crippling and killing disease. We lined up as kids. We weren't happy about it. Rolled up our sleeves and got a polio shot and virtually eradicated polio in this country. The nation hung together because the lives and safety of our children was at stake. Why can't we come to the same conclusion now? We're talking about 30 or 40% of Americans who refuse to be vaccinated. To me, that is irresponsible for themselves, for their families, for their friends, for everyone. If we're ever going to put this pandemic behind us, we have to get more people vaccinated. And I'm sorry to say that downstate Illinois is way behind Chicago and the Chicagoland area when it comes to vaccinations. Should we do everything we can to protect the kids in our school? My God, yes. If that was the case in the 1950s with polio, it certainly is the case today.
You know, for those of us who have unvaccinated children who would like to get them vaccinated, we're all sort of waiting with bated breath for the FDA to act here. Does the pace at which the FDA has acted throughout the pandemic on these topics of vaccine approval, does it seem appropriate to you?
Well, let me tell you the dilemma. I was on a telephone with Dr. Fauci. I've known him for years. I respect him. I think he's the very best. And we were on the phone about a month ago in a private conversation. And I said, when in the world is the FDA going to finally rule that these vaccines are officially safe? And we both expressed frustration about it, but we both came to the same conclusion. It would have been exactly the wrong thing for me or for him to go to hold a press conference and complain about the pace at the FDA. We wanted them to do it their way, professionally, by highest medical standards, so that we could say there was no political interference. I wish it had been done more quickly. I wish their decisions were handed out more quickly because of all the people who are dying from COVID-19. But I don't think Congress or the politicians in this country should put pressure on them.
Last thing I want to ask you about in the minute or so we have remaining is Democrats this week are beginning work on drafting a massive expansion of the social safety net. Your colleague from West Virginia and another from Arizona have already signaled they're not interested in the legislation with the $3.5 trillion with a T price tag that some have put on it. Do you view that as a negotiating position, or do you think that this is an exercise in futility, trying to do all these things that Democrats have been trying to do for a long time, putting them into this massive legislation?
Well, I hope it's a negotiating position, because the things that we're trying to achieve are dramatic, would improve the lot of families across America in many, many ways. It's about time that we gave working families, middle-income families, a break in this country when it comes to tax breaks, when it comes to extending education 2 years before pre-K, extending community college at no cost to families across America, providing ways to give people access to affordable daycare so they can get to work with peace of mind that their kids are safe, expanding the benefits under Medicare to include vision and hearing and eyesight. These are things which should have been done years ago. So I'm ready to sit down with my two colleagues or any others and work out a compromise that's reasonable. But let's not miss this opportunity to give families across America a break they deserve.
Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, thank you for being with us today here on the 21st.
My pleasure.
More to come after a short break. You're listening to the 21st. Stay with us.